Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guests are Deirdre Nealon and Kathy Faber-Langendoon. They join us today to discuss a great new collection of poetry, which they edited by the late professor and poet Bonnie St. Andrews. The book is called Round, Ripe, and Wise. Deirdre Nealon is Associate Professor of Bioethics and Humanities at SUNY Upstate Medical University. She is the editor of the university's great literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse. And Kathy Faber-Langendoon, MD, is founding chair of the Center for Bioethics and Humanities at SUNY Upstate Medical University. She holds the Medical Alumni Endowed Professorship in Bioethics and is a professor of medicine. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. Now, Bonnie St. Andrews died in 2003 at only 57. Tell us a little bit about her life.
Okay, I'll start. This is Deirdre, and her life was obviously way too short, but she packed an awful lot into it. She got two master's degrees in personnel management and something else in education, and realized that that was not what she wanted to be doing. She was always writing all her life, and so I met her when we both ended up as grad students in the English department at Syracuse University. And she just stood out as such a fine mind. I can still see her. She always took the first seat in the class and would sit curled up in it, bring her feet onto the desk, just curled up at the edge of the seat, furiously taking notes, always asking questions. I was a little bit intimidated, but fascinated. I'd never seen a woman who was so sharp, just that rapid-fire sharpness. So she finished her PhD and was a wonderful teacher, an exemplary teacher. We ended up at Upstate, which has four colleges plus the hospital. So there are multiple arenas where one can practice the art of teaching, and she certainly practiced the art of teaching. And she made friends really wherever she went and loved her colleagues and asked if she could witness some of what they did. She had great respect for people in the sciences. And so she went and witnessed an open heart surgery.
Wow.
She went to the delivery room. She went, you know, always with permission, et cetera. But there was in her, and I know, Tish, you understand this, that poet's watchfulness. The poet is always observing.
Mm.
And that's what Bonnie did in the hospital, and then would come back and write something and show it to her colleagues and say, what do you think of this? And she just got better and better at it, and her poetry appeared multiple times in JAMA, which is like the premier medical established journal that has begun publishing artistic things like poetry.
Yeah, well, her poetry certainly is absolutely astonishing, some of it. Do you have anything to say, Kathy, about
First met Bonnie a couple years after I came to the medical school in Syracuse. She was doing a poetry reading. And I don't know totally about the defects of my liberal arts education, but before then, I never really understood that poetry was meant to be heard and not just read in your mind. So she did this reading of her primarily medical poems, poems reflecting on healthcare and illness, and I was transfixed. I was just blown away, and I thought, I have to meet this woman. And so that became a great friendship and a professional relationship, and eventually I was able to attract both her and Deirdre into our emerging department, the Center for Bioethics and Humanities, and we came to support what became the Healing Muse. And
Wow. So you both had a splendid relationship with her, and it was creative as well as professional.
Very much so.
Like, yeah. Well, Deirdre, I want you to read one of Bonnie's poems in Round, Ripe, and Wise. I love that title. This one's called The New Catechism.
Okay. And I'll just say as an introduction, this shows the depth of Bonnie's interests. And this poem, although it was written now, obviously, over 15 years ago, very relevant to today. The New Catechism. Notice how sparrows cluster like dried raisins in the knife edge of north wind. As you listen to their incantations locked in ice, risk walking any street in any town in the richest country in the world. Count one by one the moss people curled against stone, warmed by a distant sun. Witness how they fortify their cardboard nests and answer truthfully, would you worship a god huddled there, invested in the have-nots? A god with CP? A god the color of Jordanian mud? A queer god whose English is imperfect, yet whose heart mirrors perfectly all hearts? A god you least expected at the high gates of good angels? A god least likely to assume the throne of thorns? Would you crown again a god like Jesus was before the priesthood reconfigured him in its exclusionary image? This meditation is an ancient offering, a kiss of consecration, pure as prayers of atonement and desire. Suffering and arrogance sleep uneasy as two thieves beside one fire. In caves beneath the altar stone, a winter wind is rising. The sparrow god is stirring. Even now, the god of sparrows is shifting shape.
Wow, I love it. I want to ask you, was she religious? Obviously, this has some religious
She was
lines and...
raised Catholic, but she would call herself, she would say she was spiritual, probably. Mm. No formalized religion by the end of her life, but always an intense interest in everybody's practice of spiritual commitments. And so she studied Buddhism. She would go to different kinds of churches occasionally, but would not align herself with one particular thing.
I recognize the Catholicism in that poem, though. I was brought up as a Catholic.
Yes.
So I recognize
Are you a
it.
Recovering one?
Yeah, I absolutely am, and so is my mother. You know what I wanted to ask you, too? She was obviously a well-respected professor. And do you think her writing was a great part of her teaching, or was it totally separate?
No, I would say it was very much a part of her teaching. And one of the best pictures I have of her, one of her students took a picture of her while she was teaching. And the blackboard is completely covered with writing. I mean, everything she did, she was writing. She was always in motion and always jotting things down. So I think when the class was over, she would jot in her notebook any ideas that had come to her or things the students had said that she admired would be on the board. And she was very loath to begin erasing a board. She would study the board and look at it and then, you know, write some things down. And then, so I think everything went hand in hand with her.
Yeah. I wonder, some people do have separate, you know, my teaching is this and my creativity is a separate world. Yeah. I want to talk about the fact that Bonnie's book includes all these reproductions of famous artists. To tell us about her connection with art.
Bonnie loved visual art and sought a lot of inspiration from it, received a lot of inspiration. Early on in her office, when she was setting her office up, her office at the center, she hung a painting one place. And I come back a couple weeks later, and there's a different painting there. Mm. And I says, so that didn't work out? And she says, oh, no, I like to change my art. I like to look at it differently. You stop looking at it if it hangs in the same place at the same time forever. And I think it just showed her active mind and her appreciation and her really intense ability to look.
Mm.
And so she had this thread of poetry reflecting on the visual arts. Actually, Wells College published a book of her poems reflecting art.
That's the one, Learning from Renoir, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's a masterfully produced book from their book arts program. It wasn't able to include actual reproductions of the art that she reflected on. In the first time I heard her read, she did her reading with the art in the background, PowerPoint slides of the art, and it was captivating to go back and forth hearing and seeing. And so one of the great things we could do in this book was to work really hard and through the generosity of a variety of art museums around the world, reproduce the actual masterpieces alongside the art, which we hope really lends a more vibrant experience to the reader.
Oh, absolutely. It helps you understand her work.
Yeah, totally.
For sure.
And I would just add that, you know, part of our teaching is that you go to conferences, you go to professional conferences, and wherever we went, one day had to be at the museum.
Mm.
So we would leave the conference, and again, she with the notebook, And she would just sit and stare at a painting for a long time, jotting things. And I might find the poem, you know, a year later in its fuller form.
Well, but did her creativity always come out in poetry, or did she at one time entertain the idea of being a painter?
She never told me that she entertained the idea of being a painter. She sometimes would color, and she was sort of funny, like, you know, almost embarrassed that she had colored pencils and would, no formal people, just shapes, very much into, like, mandala-type things. And she would say to me that that was a form of meditation for her to play around that way.
Yeah. Why, her poetry seems like a form of meditation,
yes,
too.
Yes, definitely.
At least for all us who get have the pleasure of reading it.
Yes.
Now, another poem from the new collection. Kathy, I'd like you to read Night Mail.
Sure. Night Mail is a poem reflecting on dreams. So, Night Mail. Talmudic scholars say dreams are letters that must be opened, bitter as wise counsel, nourishing as psalms. With chilling calm, scientists make pronouncements just as alarming. They refuse to be amazed that we, and they, dream away 6 years of life. They seem unperturbed that the mail keeps piling up, that 50,000 hours of keen communiques recede like tides upon the beaches of our waking. Wisdom in silence coils behind our eyes, descends in darkness, making its ways across our minefield of defenses. Hooded REM scans symbols, flicks once its vermilion tongue, then sends sealed missives to a restive world. That's one-third dream, two-thirds regret.
Well, I found that one kind of a little bit sad, a little bit full of regrets. Yeah.
Yes, it's sort of that sense that there's this part of the world that's slipping by you. There's so much time spent in it, and it's there, but it eludes us. But isn't that the experience that you have when you wake and there's just that thread of a dream that goes floating off and you try to grab for it and it's gone?
Yeah.
So I think she really powerfully plays off of that sense that there's that whole huge chunk of our life that's going on and it's gone.
Yeah. And it's great that she was able to capture that in poetic terms. Most of us say, I forget.
You know what I mean? Yes.
When did she reveal these poems to you? Did you see them before she died? Or were these things that you discovered afterwards?
No. Saw them before she died. She had about 3 years in our department, so 2 years before she fell ill. And things were just humming, and she's cranking out poems for JAMA and the Parish Review and the New Yorker and all over. And we're dreaming of ways to make the muse grow. We publish our inaugural issue. I became aware of all of her poems, which lived in utter chaos on her computer in ancient versions of software and multiple copies. And it was sort of a poetic creative mess in terms of in terms of organization. And so we talked about what the potential was to mine that for further poetry. And then when she fell ill from a brain tumor, I could see the likelihood of what would happen and felt like the window could close, and we really need to bring order to that and understand what all was there and to kind of race against time. And so that next 11 months of her life, insofar as she was able, she and I spent hours on her computer and cleaning up the poetry in multiple copies, and I would print up poems, and there are multiple versions, and say, which is the definitive one? Which do you like? This one says this, this one says that, and trying to get her sense of the definitive. So that by the time she died, and then working on it the next couple of years, Deirdre and I were able to create a sort of definitive set of all of her poetry, ranging from fragments to things that have been fully published.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Deirdre Nealon and Kathy Faber-Langendoon. We're talking about a book that they edited by Bonnie St. Andrews. It's called Round, Ripe, and Wise. And I want to talk to you about the fact that Bonnie founded the Healing Muse magazine. To tell us about that.
Yeah, that was Bonnie. She was teaching at that point primarily in the College of Nursing. And she felt that the nurses had many, many stories that they did not tell anybody, and that they were not, as a profession, encouraged to write at that time. Physicians were beginning to do writing more commonly, but it hadn't really spread into nursing. And so Bonnie was doing some writing classes with the nurses, and she asked them, you know, would they be interested in having a publication? And so they said yes. And so that was the beginnings of her trying. The prototype of this was called the Silverman Review, and that was named after the building that she was teaching in. But she quickly decided that it would be really smart to have medicine feature, particularly a university, a medical university, feature conversations in the arts about healing or dying, or getting better, or what it's like to hear a diagnosis, what it's like to give a diagnosis, that all of these very, very dramatic things are happening, and people don't write them down.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it began as an in-house, the Healing Muse. The first issue is really mostly just people from upstate. But by the second issue, thanks to Kathy really saying, I'm behind this 100%. I will give you time in your academic life to do this journal. We began to do outreach and talk to people in central New York and then downstate. And then with the web, with the explosion of the internet, it's what it is today, which we hear from all over the world. She would be so
amazing.
Delighted. I mean, her death is tragic on so many levels, but a big one is that she didn't get to see this dream she had be as wonderful as it is.
Oh, yeah. When she started publishing it, did she publish her own work in it?
No.
Or did she just keep it for
She kept it for outside. The nurses and the outside people and really trying to get them, Tish, to believe in themselves, that they are witnessing, and it's important as a witness to write down what you see. And I think that made her more excited, really, than if she were writing her work in the Muse, to give somebody who had not had a chance yet to see what it's like to be published, to stand up, to read your words, to have somebody come up to you and say, wow, that was really good.
Yeah, yeah. And we have said that quite a few times in the last few years.
Yes, we have. Yes, we have.
Kathy, I want to have you read another from Ripe, Round, and Wise. This one's called Sonogram.
Sure. Sonogram. On this gray steel gurney with starched white sheets, she lies as if asleep, but she is wide awake. Washed with dreams, she floats, white boat on whiter water. Piercing her abdomen like a needle-nosed gar, a camera dives beneath her surfaces, exploring amniotic seas. At rest, then leaping suddenly with shifting tides, one tiny orca rides, sending greetings from the same transducer through which all meanings start. When that fetal heart, small and dark and sweet as pomegranate seed, beats alive, alive, this TV monitor is a sacred place where almost mother lifts almost child in a watery embrace.
Oh, that's a beautiful poem.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. You know, I know from my own experience how hypersensitive and hyper-aware I became after my first heart surgery and now this recent heart attack. I was wondering, did she write some of these after her illness, or were some of them written before just from observing? Like you said, she used to observe and be curious about heart surgeries. And to tell us, do you know?
The poems in the collection were not written after her illness, but she did write several poems after a pretty severe bicycle accident that she had, where she sustained a fair number of injuries. And that definitely generated a fair amount of musing and writing about fragility and recovery and how life changes in an instant sort of
thing. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I would say, Tish, you know, she did try to write during those last 11 months, but she oftentimes didn't like what she had written. Mm-hmm. So she would show me a few lines and she would say, it's just not right. And you could see there was something in her mind that she wanted on the page, but it wasn't coming through. The illness definitely made a difference. So I don't think we have, I have fragments of things, but I wouldn't publish them because probably I don't think she would have said, yes, that's me.
So was this blockading her because of the illness or just because she couldn't talk about it?
No, I think the illness, the glioblastoma, makes your ordinary actions very difficult.
Oh, yeah.
It's a different life.
I can imagine. Well, what were the challenges of putting this collection together? Obviously, you probably couldn't put her whole body of work on. What were your choices based on?
That's a great question. We've done this twice. I mean, we tried to put a collection together within 2 years of her, maybe even within 1 year of her death, and that was very difficult. That was very emotional, and we did it. I mean, we put one together, and we tried to shop it around, but the only thing harder to push than a live poet is a dead poet. Not to put too fine a point on it, even though we offered to go and do the readings, we were told very nicely by different poetry houses, this just isn't anything we can do.
Mm-hmm. So I keep thinking of Emily Dickinson. I just want to insert. Now, there's a woman who clearly has published many, many poems, but almost all after she died. And I just keep thinking about old E.D., and I think there's so much treasure within Bonnie's poems. And it's been really important to me that it not just live on our computers in the center, and every time we publish another volume of the journal, we pick out one of her poems and put it in, but it seems like such a small offering. Those poems should be shared, and they should be read.
Oh, absolutely.
So it was one of those work bucket list things that it's like, we are going to get this out. We publish a beautiful journal. Why not do it ourselves? We have a great network of readers and people who support the Muse, and to at least get it out there and give people the pleasure of enjoying her poetry.
You know, I find it remarkable that they didn't want to publish a dead poet. No, honestly, I mean, look at how big Sylvia Plath became, you know, things like that. But not just that, you know, for humor's sake, but I think it's so valuable, some of the material people have written who've had illness or finally died. What we're missing.
Right. Well, we remain optimistic that somehow we plant these seeds and who knows where they will sprout, and maybe it will simply bring some joy and peace and perspective to the readers who get our first 1,000 copies, and who knows what will happen.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, Deirdre, I want you to read the final poem. This one is called Dear Ms. Capulet.
Yes, and I chose this one, Tish, because I wanted your listeners to know that Bonnie had a great sense of humor, and she was always reading. She was a great reader as well as a writer. And there was an article one time about how Verona, Italy, which is where Romeo and Juliet is set, has a place that people leave messages to Juliet, some to Romeo, but mostly to Juliet, and they stick them in the wall there. And Bonnie got just quite a kick out of people asking Juliet for advice about their love life. So she came up with this poem, and she has an epigram in it. It says, the number of letters per year addressed to Juliet in Verona, Italy, 1,000. That was in the year 1993. So here's Dear Miss Capulet. 1, Maxine, Sydney. It's not about who's the sun, honey, or how high's the moon. Drop the knife. Get a life. He's a greaser, a brawler, a hood. You're too good to take a dive. Survive to be the woman you should. 2, Gordon, East Chicago. Come forth, Venus, from your coffin of desire. You yearn to be the white-hot center of love's ever-sacred fire. I wait for you, and you alone, at 42 Hephaestus Road, Chicago, and Juliet. I burn. 3, Amarinda from Sri Lanka. I envy you your pain, having stained my soul to cleanse my family's name. 47 years ago, I took a bet I could forget my lover's face, yet remember how to feel. Rather had I, like you, chosen swift blue steel, than year by year be ground beneath love's relentless heel. 4. Emily from Little Eddings, Sussex. I know, Juliet, what it means to be star-crossed, nailed and left hanging on love's tree, only to find insufficient poison on the lover's frozen lips to set the spirit free. 5. Blanche and Amy from Boise. Jules, stop! Look around! Stop! Boyfriends, cousins, your betrothed, stop! All testosterone, crazed suitors, stop! Bent on killing each other, stop! Can't save you or themselves, stop! Leave them, leave nurse, leave mother, stop! Find yourself a woman lover.
I love that. That was what? How inventive that was to take it from that
so great
launch point, you know? I know this is the 15th anniversary since Bonnie died. And just real quickly, what are your most memorable, what are your greatest memories of her?
Oh, wow. I have so many. I mean, my greatest one is just sitting with her, talking. Reading a book together and talking about the book, or sipping a glass of wine in front of the fireplace and listening to how her mind worked. It was truly a work of art, and I miss it.
I think it's being attracted by the intensity of how she listened to the person in front of her. She is truly one of those people where many people would claim, oh, she was my best friend. She's like, she so was acutely present. And in the morning when I come into work, she was there early in the morning. I would come in and we would just chat about the day. She had a rocking chair in front of her desk. And one day she was going to be going off for a couple weeks on vacation. And she said, you may come and sit in my rocking chair while I'm gone. It was just such a thoughtful being the chair of the department, you know, I'm there to help the faculty. I'm there to take care of what the dean wants. And it was rare to have a faculty member who was so interested in my well-being and really listening and helping. It was a great treasure.
That's great. Everlasting memories and the poetry. Wow.
Yeah.
We are almost out of time. Where can people buy this book if they want to?
They can go online to thehealingmuse.org. And you will find information there how to get in touch with us and call us up and we'll send you a copy. It's $10.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure. Again, the book is by Bonnie St. Andrews and it's called Around Ripe and Wise. Thank you, Deirdre and Kathy. Thank you.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.